The Olin Institute at Harvard and other institutions. These institutes have done their job very well. People associated with them have written more books than the people on the left have on all issues. The conservatives support their intellectuals. They create media opportunities. They have media studios down the hall in their institutes so that getting on TV is easy. When the amount of research money spent by the right over a period of time is compared with the amount of media time during that period, we see a direct correlation. At present, the Koch brothers are pouring money into right-wing campaigns. This is not an accident. Conservatives, through their think tanks, figured out the importance of framing, and they figured out how to frame every issue. They figured out how to get those frames out there. How to get their people in the media all the time. They set up training institutes. The Leadership Institute in Virginia trains tens of thousands of conservatives a year and runs constant programs around the United States and in 15 foreign countries. Trained conservative spokespeople receive regular talking points and are booked by booking agencies on radio, TV, and other local venues. Conservatives figured out how to bring their people together. Every Wednesday, Grover Norquist has a group meeting, around 80 people, of leaders from the full range of the right. They are invited and they debate. They work out their differences, agree to disagree, and when they disagree, they trade off. The idea is, this week he'll win on his issue, next week I'll win on mine. Each one may not get everything he wants, but over the long haul he gets a lot of what he wants. The meetings have gone on for 2 decades. In recent years, the Wednesday morning Norquist meetings have expanded to 48 states. Via ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, conservatism has spread at the state level, allowing conservatives to take over state legislatures, gerrymander congressional districts, and take over the House of Representatives with a minority of national voter support. It is only in the wake of the 2008 Obama sweep that the radical conservative Tea Party movement has split from the previously unified conservative movement. The progressive world has not caught up. And what is worse is a set of myths believed by liberals and progressives. These myths come from a good source, but they end up hurting us badly. The myths began with the Enlightenment, and the first one goes like this. The truth will set us free. If we just tell people the facts, since people are basically rational beings, they'll all reach the right conclusions. But we know from cognitive science that people do not think like that. People think in frames. The strict father and nurturant parent frames each force a certain logic. To be accepted, the truth must fit people's frames. If the facts do not fit a frame, the frame stays and the facts bounce off. Why? Neuroscience tells us that each of the concepts we have, the long-term concepts that structure how we think, is instantiated in the synapses of our brains. Concepts are not things that can be changed just by someone telling us a fact. We may be presented with facts, but for us to make sense of them, they have to fit what is already in the synapses of the brain. Otherwise, facts go in and then they go right back out. They are not heard, or they are not accepted as facts, or they mystify us. Why would anyone have said that? Then we label the fact as irrational, crazy, or stupid. That's what happens when progressives just confront conservatives with the facts. It has little or no effect unless the conservatives have a frame that makes sense of the facts. Similarly, a lot of progressives hear conservatives talk and do not understand them because they do not have the conservatives' frames. They assume that conservatives are stupid. They are not stupid. They are winning because they are smart. They understand how people think and how people talk. They think. That is what those think tanks are about. They support their intellectuals. They write all those books. They put their ideas out in public. There are certainly cases where conservatives have lied. That is true. Of course, it is not true that only conservatives lie, but it is true that there were significant lies, even daily lies, by the Bush administration. However, it is equally important to recognize that many of the ideas that outrage progressives are what conservatives see as truths, presented from their point of view. We must distinguish cases of out-and-out distortion, lying, and so on, from cases where conservatives are presenting what they consider truth. Is it useful to go and tell everyone what the lies are? Well, it is certainly not useless or harmful for us to know when they are lying, but also remember that the truth alone will not set you free. The scientific facts about global warming are stated and restated day after day around the country, but they fall on conservative deaf brains, brains with frames that don't fit those facts. There is another myth that also comes from the Enlightenment, and it goes like this. It is irrational to go against your self-interest, and therefore a normal person who is rational reasons on the basis of self-interest. Modern economic theory and foreign policy are set upon the basis of that assumption. The myth has been challenged by cognitive scientists such as Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his theory, and Amos Tversky, who have shown that people do not really think that way. Nevertheless, most of economics is still based on the assumption that people will naturally always think in terms of their self-interest. This view of rationality comes into democratic politics in a very important way. It is assumed that voters will vote their self-interest. Democrats are shocked or puzzled when voters do not vote their self-interest. How, Democrats keep asking me, can any poor person vote for Republicans when Republican policies hurt them so badly? The Democratic response is to try to explain over and over to the conservative poor why voting Democratic would serve their self-interest. Despite all evidence that this is a bad strategy, Democrats keep banging their heads against the wall. In the 2012 election, Democrats argued that Mitt Romney's policies would only help the rich. But most poor conservatives still voted Republican against their self-interest, even though Romney was recorded saying not very nice things about the poor in general. It is claimed that about a third of the populace thinks that they are or someday will be in the top 1%, and that for this reason they vote on the basis of a hoped-for future self-interest. But what about the other two-thirds who have no dream that they will ever get super rich? They are clearly not voting in their self-interest or even their hoped-for future self-interest. People do not necessarily vote in their self-interest. They vote their identity. They vote their values. They vote for who they identify with. They may identify with their self-interest. That can happen. It is not that people never care about their self-interest. But they vote their identity. And if their identity fits their self-interest, they will vote for that. It is important to understand this point. It is a serious mistake to assume that people are simply always voting in their self-interest. A third mistake is this. There is a metaphor that political campaigns are marketing campaigns where the candidate is the product and the candidate's positions on issues are the features and qualities of the product. This leads to the conclusion that polling should determine which issues a candidate should run on. Which issue shows the highest degree of support for a candidate's position? If it's prescription drugs, you run on a platform featuring prescription drugs. Is it keeping Social Security? Then you run on a platform featuring Social Security. You make a list of the top issues, and those are the issues you run on. You also do market segmentation. District by district, you find out the most important issues, and those are the ones you talk about when you go to that district. It does not work. Sometimes it can be helpful, and in fact the Republicans use it in addition to their real practice. But their real practice and the real reasons for their success is this. They say what they idealistically believe. They say it. They talk to their base using the frames of their base. Liberal and progressive candidates tend to follow their polls and decide that they have to become more centrist by moving to the right. The conservatives do not move at all to the left, and yet they win. Why? What is the electorate like from a cognitive point of view? Probably 35 to 40% of people have a strict father model governing their politics. Similarly, there are people who have a nurturant view governing their politics, probably another 35 to 40%. And then there are all the people who are said to be in the middle. There is no ideology of the middle. There is no moral system or political position that defines the middle. The people in the middle are largely bi-conceptuals, people who are conservative on some issues and progressives on others, in all sorts of combinations. Notice that I said governing their politics. We all have both models, either actively or passively. Progressives see a John Wayne movie or an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, and they can understand it. They do not say, "I don't know what's going on in this movie." They have a strict father model, at least passively. And if you are a conservative and you understand Oprah, you have a nurturant parent model, at least passively. Everyone has both worldviews because both worldviews are widely present in our culture. But people do not necessarily live by one worldview all of the time. So, the question is, are you living by one of the family-based models? But that question is not specific enough. There are many aspects of life, and many people live by one family-based model in one part of their lives and another in another part of their lives. I have colleagues who are nurturant parents at home and liberals in their politics, but strict fathers in their classrooms. Reagan knew that blue-collar workers who were nurturant in their union politics were often strict fathers at home. He used political metaphors that were based on the home and family, and got them to extend their strict father way of thinking from the home to politics. This is very important to understand. The goal is to activate your model in the people in the middle. The people who are in the middle have both models, used regularly in different parts of their lives. What you want to do is to get them to use your model for politics, to activate your worldview and moral system in their political decisions. You do that by talking to people using frames based on your worldview. However, in doing that, you do not want to offend the people in the middle who have up to this point made the opposite choice. Since they have and use both models in their lives, they might still be persuaded to activate the opposite model for politics. Clinton figured out how to handle this problem. He stole the other side's language. He talked about welfare reform, for example. He said the age of big government is over. He did what he wanted to do, only he took their language and used their words to describe it. It made them very mad. It turns out what is good for the goose is good for the gander, and guess what? When George W. Bush arrived, we got compassionate conservatism, the Clear Skies Initiative, healthy forests, no child left behind. This is the use of language to mollify people who have nurturant values while the real policies are strict father policies. This can even attract the people in the middle who might have qualms about you. This is the use of Orwellian language, language that means the opposite of what it says, to appease people in the middle at the same time as you pump up the base. That is part of the conservative strategy. Liberals and progressives typically react to this strategy in a self-defeating way. The usual reaction is, "Those conservatives are bad people. They are using Orwellian language. They are saying the opposite of what they mean. They are deceivers. Bad, bad." All true. But we should recognize that they use Orwellian language precisely when they have to, when they are weak, when they cannot just come out and say what they mean. Imagine they came out supporting a dirty skies bill, or a forest destruction bill, or a kill public education bill. They would lose. They are aware people do not support what they are really trying to do. Orwellian language points to weakness. Orwellian weakness. When you hear Orwellian language, note where it is, because it is a guide to where they are vulnerable. They do not use it everywhere. It is very important to notice this and use their weakness to your advantage. A very good example relates to the environment. The Rights Language Man is Frank Lutz, who puts out books of language guidelines which are used as training manuals for conservative candidates, as well as lawyers, judges, and other public speakers, even high school students who want to be conservative public figures. In these books, Lutz tells you what language to use for a conservative advantage. It was Lutz who persuaded conservatives to stop talking about global warming because it sounded too scary and suggested human agency. Instead, he brought climate change into our public discourse on the grounds that climate sounded kind of nice. Think palm trees. And change just happens, with no human agency. By 2003, with the scientific consensus going against conservatives, Lutz suggested Orwellian language. He suggested using words like healthy, clean, and safe even when talking about coal or nuclear power plants. Hence, clean coal. Conservative legislation that increases pollution is called the Clear Skies Act. He is supporting global warming denial by suggesting that people say that the science is not settled and that our economy should not be threatened. Recently, his focus group research showed support for cap-and-trade legislation. He has suggested using the language of energy independence, which supports continued fracking, but not talking about saving the planet. Lutz once wrote a memo for talking to women. How do you talk to women? According to Lutz, women like certain words, so when you are talking to an audience of women, here are the words you use as many times as possible. Love, from the heart, and for the children. And if you read George W. Bush's speeches from that period, love, from the heart, and for the children show up over and over again. This kind of language use is a science. Like any science, it can be used honestly or harmfully. This kind of language use is taught. This kind of language use is also a discipline. Conservatives enforce message discipline. In many offices, there is a pizza fund. Every time you use the wrong language, you have to put a quarter in the pizza fund. People quickly learn to say tax relief or partial birth abortion, not something else. But Lutz is about much more than language. He recognizes that the right use of language starts with ideas, with the right framing of the issues, a framing that reflects a consistent conservative moral perspective, what we have called strict father morality. Lutz's writing is not just about language. For each issue, he explains what the conservative reasoning is, what the progressive reasoning is, and how the progressive arguments can best be attacked from a conservative perspective. He is clear. Ideas come first. One of the major mistakes liberals make is that they think they have all the ideas they need. They think that all they lack is media access, or maybe some magic bullet phrases, the liberal equivalent of partial birth abortion. When you think you just lack words, what you really lack are ideas. Ideas come in the form of frames. When the frames are there, the words come readily. There's a way you can tell when you lack the right frames. There's a phenomenon you have probably noticed. A conservative on TV uses two words like tax relief. and the progressive has to go into a paragraph-long discussion of his own view. The conservative can appeal to an established frame, that taxation is an affliction or burden which allows for the two-word phrase tax relief. But there is no established frame on the other side. You can talk about it, but it takes some doing because there is no established frame, no fixed idea already out there. In cognitive science, there is a name for this phenomenon. It's called hypocognition, the lack of the ideas you need, the lack of a relatively simple fixed frame that can be evoked by a word or two. The idea of hypocognition comes from a study in Tahiti in the 1950s by the late anthropologist Bob Levy, who was also a therapist. Levy addressed the question of why there were so many suicides in Tahiti and discovered that Tahitians did not have a concept of grief. They felt grief, they experienced it, but they did not have a concept for it or a name for it. They did not see it as a normal emotion. There were no rituals around grief, no grief counseling, nothing like it. They lacked a concept they needed, and wound up committing suicide all too often. Progressives are suffering from massive hypocognition. The conservatives used to suffer from it. When Goldwater lost in 1964, they had very few of the concepts that they have today. In the intermediate 50 years, conservative thinkers have filled in their conceptual gaps. But our conceptual gaps are still there. Let's go back to tax relief. What is taxation? Taxation is what you pay to live in a civilized country, what you pay to have democracy and opportunity, and what you pay to use the infrastructure paid for by previous taxpayers. The highway system, the internet, the entire scientific establishment, the medical establishment, the communication system, the airline system, all are or were paid for by taxpayers. You can think of taxation metaphorically in at least two ways. First, as an investment. Imagine the following ad. Our parents invested in the future. Ours as well as theirs, through their taxes. They invested their tax money in the interstate highway system, the internet, the scientific and medical establishments, our communications system, our airline system, the space program. They invested in the future, and we are reaping the tax benefits, the benefits from the taxes they paid. Today we have assets, highways, schools and colleges, the internet, airlines, that come from the wise investments they made. Imagine versions of this ad running over and over for years. Eventually the frame would be established. Taxes are wise investments in the future. Or take another metaphor. Taxation is paying your dues, paying your membership fee in America. If you join a country club or a community center, you pay fees. Why? You did not build the swimming pool. You have to maintain it. You did not build the basketball court. Someone has to clean it. You may not use the squash court, but you still have to pay your dues. Otherwise, it won't be maintained and will fall apart. People who avoid taxes, like corporations that move to Bermuda, are not paying their dues to the country. It is patriotic to be a taxpayer. It is traitorous to desert our country and not pay your dues. Perhaps Bill Gates Sr. said it best. In arguing to keep the inheritance tax, he pointed out that he and Bill Jr. did not invent the internet. They just used it to make billions. There is no such thing as a self-made man. Every businessman has used the vast American infrastructure which the taxpayers paid for to make his money. He did not make his money alone. He used taxpayer infrastructure. He got rich on what other taxpayers had paid for. The banking system, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury and Commerce Departments, and the judicial system, where 9/10 of cases involve corporate law. These taxpayer investments support companies and wealthy investors. There are no self-made men. The wealthy have gotten rich using what previous taxpayers have paid for. They owe the taxpayers of this country a great deal and should be paying it back. These are accurate views of taxes, but they are not yet enshrined in our brains. They need to be repeated over and over again and refined until they take their rightful place in our synapses. But that takes time. It does not happen overnight. Start now. It is not an accident that conservatives are winning where they have successfully framed the issues. They've got a 40 to 50 year head start, and more than $2 billion in think tank investments. And they are still thinking ahead. Progressives are not. Progressives feel so assaulted by conservatives that they can only think about immediate defense. Democratic office holders are constantly under attack. Every day they have to respond to conservative initiatives. It is always, what do we have to do to fight them off today? This leads to politics that are reactive, not proactive. And it is not just public officials. I have been talking to advocacy groups around the country, working with them and trying to help them with framing issues. I have worked with more than 400 advocacy groups in this way. They have the same problems. They are under attack all the time, and they are trying to defend themselves against the next attack. Realistically, they do not have time to plan. They do not have time to think long term. They do not have time to think beyond their particular issues. They are all good people, intelligent, committed people, but they are constantly on the defensive. Why? It is not hard to explain it when we think about funding. The right-wing think tanks get large block grants and endowments, millions at a time. They are very well funded. Furthermore, they know that they are going to get the money the next year and the year after that. Remember, these are block grants, no strings attached. Do what you need. Hire intellectuals. Bring talent along. These institutions also build human capital for the future. Progressive foundations spread the money around, thinly. They give $25,000 here, maybe $50,000, maybe even $100,000. Sometimes it is a big grant, but the recipients have to do something different from what everybody else is doing because the foundations see duplication as a waste of money. Not only that, but also they are not block grants like conservative foundations get. The recipients do not have full freedom to decide how to spend the money. And it is certainly not appropriate to use it for career development or infrastructure building or hiring intellectuals to think about long-term as well as short-term or interrelated policies. The emphasis is on providing direct services to the people who need the services. Grassroots funding, not infrastructure creation. This is, for the most part, how progressive foundations work. And because of that, the organizations they fund have to have a very narrow focus. They have to have projects, not just areas they work on. Activists and advocates are overworked and underpaid, and they do not have time or energy to think about how they should be linking up with other people. They mainly do not have the time or training to think about framing their issues. The system forces a narrow focus. And with it, isolation. You ask, why is it like this? There is a reason. There is a deep reason, and it is a reason you should think about. In the right's hierarchy of moral values, the top value is preserving and defending the moral system itself. If that is your main goal, what do? You build infrastructure. You buy up media in advance. You plan ahead. You do things like give fellowships to right-wing law students to get them through law school if they join the Federalist Society. And you get them nice jobs after that. If you want to extend your worldview, it is very smart to make sure that over the long haul you have the people and the resources that you need. On the left, the highest value is helping individuals who need help. So, if you are a foundation or you are setting up a foundation, what makes you a good person? You help as many people as you can. And the more public budgets get cut, the more people there are who need help. So you spread the money around to the grassroots organizations, and therefore you do not have any money left for infrastructure or talent development, and certainly not for intellectuals. Do not waste a penny in duplicating efforts, because you have to help more and more people. How do you show that you are a good moral person or foundation? By listing all the people you help. The more, the better. And so you perpetuate a system that helps the right. In the process, it also does help people. Certainly, it is not that people do not need help. They do. But what has happened as budgets and taxes get cut is that the right is privatizing the left. The right is forcing the left to spend ever more private money on what the government should be supporting. There are many things that we can do about all this. Let's talk about where to start. The right knows how to talk about values. We need to talk about values. If we think about it a little, we can list our values, but it is not easy to think about how the values fit the issues. To know how to talk about every issue from the perspective of our values, not theirs. Progressives also have to look at the integration of issues. This is something that the right is very, very savvy about. They know about what I call strategic initiatives. A strategic initiative is a plan in which a change in one carefully chosen issue area has automatic effects over many, many, many other issue areas. For example, tax cuts. This seems straightforward, but as a result of tax cuts, there's not enough money in the budget for any of the government's social programs. Not just not enough money for, say, homelessness or schools or environmental protection. Instead, not enough money for everything at once, the whole range. This is a strategic initiative. Or tort reform, which means putting limits on awards in lawsuits. Tort reform is a top priority for conservatives. Why do conservatives care so much about this? Well, as soon as you see the effects, you can see why they care. Because in one stroke, you prohibit all of the potential lawsuits that will be the basis of future environmental legislation and regulation. That is, it is not just regulation of the chemical industry or the coal industry or the nuclear power industry or other things that are at stake. It is the regulation of everything. If parties who are harmed cannot sue immoral or negligent corporations or professionals for significant sums, the companies are free to harm the public in unlimited ways in the course of making money. And lawyers who take risks and make significant investments in such cases will no longer make enough money to support the risk. And corporations will be free to ignore the public good. That is what tort reform is about. In addition, if you look at where Democrats get much of their money in the individual states, it is significantly from the lawyers who win tort cases. Many tort lawyers are important Democratic donors. Tort reform, as conservatives call it, cuts off this source of money. All of a sudden, three-quarters of the money going to the Texas Democratic Party is not there. In addition, companies who poison the environment want to be able to cap possible awards. That way, they can calculate in advance the cost of paying victims and build it into the cost of doing business. Irresponsible corporations win big from tort reform. The Republican Party wins big from tort reform. And these real purposes are hidden. The issue appears to be eliminating frivolous lawsuits. People getting $30 million for having hot coffee spilled on them. However, what the conservatives are really trying to achieve is not in the proposal. What they are trying to achieve follows from enacting the proposal. They don't care primarily about the lawsuits themselves. They care about getting rid of environmental, consumer, and worker protections in general. And they care about defunding the Democratic Party. That is what a strategic initiative is. There have been a couple of strategic initiatives on the left, environmental impact reports and the Endangered Species Act, but it has been 40 years since they were enacted. Unlike the right, the left does not think strategically. We think issue by issue. We generally do not try to figure out what minimal change we can enact that will have effects across many issues. There are very few exceptions. There are also strategic initiatives of another kind, what I call slippery slope initiatives. Take the first step and you're on your way off the cliff. Conservatives are very good at slippery slope initiatives. Take partial birth abortion. There are almost no such cases. Why do conservatives care so much? Because it is a first step down a slippery slope to ending all abortion. It puts out there a frame of abortion as a horrendous procedure when most operations ending pregnancy are nothing like this. Why an education bill about school testing? Once the testing frame applies not just to students but also to schools, then schools can metaphorically fail and be punished for failing by having their allowance cut. Less funding in turn makes it harder for the schools to improve, which leads to a cycle of failure and ultimately elimination for many public schools. What replaces the public school system is a voucher system to support private schools. The wealthy would have good schools, paid for in part by what used to be tax payments for public schools. The poor would not have the money for good schools. We would wind up with a two-tier school system, a good one for the deserving rich, and a bad one for the undeserving poor. The conservatives don't have to win on issue after issue after issue. There are many things a progressive can do about it. Here are 11. First, notice what conservatives have done right and where progressives have missed the boat. It is more than just control of the media, though that is far from trivial. What they have done right is to successfully frame the issues from their perspective. Acknowledge their successes and our failures. Second, remember, don't think of an elephant. If you keep their language and their framing and just argue against it, you lose because you are reinforcing their frame. Third, the truth alone will not set you free. Just speaking truth to power doesn't work. You need to frame the truths effectively from your perspective. Fourth, you need to speak from your moral perspective at all times. Progressive policies follow from progressive values. Get clear on your values and use the language of values. Drop the language of policy wonks. Fifth, understand where conservatives are coming from. Get their strict father morality and its consequences clear. Know what you are arguing against. Be able to explain why they believe what they believe. Try to predict what they will say. Sixth, think strategically across issue areas. Think in terms of large moral goals, not in terms of programs for their own sake. Seventh, think about the consequences of proposals. Form progressive slippery slope initiatives. Eighth, remember that voters vote their identity and their values, which need not coincide with their self-interest. Ninth, unite and cooperate. Here's how. Remember the six modes of progressive thought. 1. Socioeconomic. 2. Identity politics. 3. Environmentalist. 4. Civil libertarian, 5. Spiritual, and 6. Anti-authoritarian. Notice which of these modes of thought you use most often, where you fall on the spectrum, and where the people you talk to fall on the spectrum. Then rise above your own mode of thought and start thinking and talking from shared progressive values. 10th, be proactive, not reactive. Play offense, not defense. Practice reframing every day on every issue. Don't just say what you believe. Use your frames, not their frames. Use them because they fit the values you believe in. 11th, speak to the progressive base in order to activate the nurturant model of biconceptual voters. Don't move to the right. Rightward movement hurts in two ways. It alienates the progressive base, and it helps conservatives by activating their model in biconceptual voters. Part 2. Framing 102. Framing the Unframed. Chapter 2. Framing the Unframed. There are two common mistakes people make when thinking about framing. The first mistake is believing that framing is a matter of coming up with clever slogans like death tax or partial birth abortion that resonate with a significant segment of the population. Those slogans only work when there has been a long, often decades-long, campaign of framing issues like taxation and abortion conceptually, so that the brains of many people are prepared to accept those phrases. I was once asked if I could reframe, that is, provide a winning slogan for a global warming bill by next Tuesday. I laughed. Effective reframing is the changing of millions of brains to be prepared to recognize a reality. That preparation hadn't been done. The second mistake is believing that if only we could present the facts about a certain reality in some effective way, then people would wake up to that reality, change their personal opinion, and start acting politically to change society. Why can't people wake up is the complaint, as if people are asleep and just have to be aroused to see and comprehend the world around them. But the reality is that certain ideas have to be ingrained in us, developed over time consistently and precisely enough to create an accurate frame for our understanding. Here is an example. Pensions, even by those who advocate for them, are often framed as benefits, extras granted by an employer to the employed. Yet what is a pension, really? A pension is delayed payment for work already done. As a condition for taking a job, a pension is part of your earned salary, withheld and invested by your employer to be paid later after retirement. So, if an employer says, "We just don't have the money to pay for your pension," that means that he has either embezzled, stolen, or misspent your earnings, which by contract he is responsible for paying you. Your employer is a thief. I've had the repeated experience of talking to union leaders and groups of workers pointing out to them that a pension is delayed payment for work already done. I get universal agreement. Then I ask, "Have you ever said it?" "No." "Do you believe it?" "Yes." "Would you start saying it?" That is where it gets difficult. Even for progressives, it is hard to shake the frame constructed over years by pundits on the right that pensions are pay for not working. Yet the fact that pensions are delayed payments is an obvious truth that would undermine the idea promulgated by pundits on the right that pensions are pay for not working. So why can people perceive an important truth on a topic crucial to them, a truth that needs to be out in public, and not say it, not make it part of their everyday discourse? The reason is that just telling someone something usually does not make it a neural circuit that they use every day, or even a neural circuit that fits easily into their pre-existing brain circuitry. The neural circuits that define their previous understandings and forms of discourse. It is difficult to say things that you are not sure the public is ready to hear, to say things that have not been said hundreds of times before. As noted in Chapter 1, this problem has a name, hypocognition, the lack of the overall neural circuitry that makes common sense of the idea and that fits the forms of communication that one normally engages in, the things you are ready to say and that the people you speak to are ready to hear. Slogans can't overcome hypocognition. Only sustained public discussion has a chance. And that takes knowledge of the problem and a large-scale, serious commitment to work for a change. Several important issues that confront us right now, from global warming to the wealth gap and beyond, demand this kind of sustained discussion and commitment. I am offering this section of the book in the hope that various readers will take on the various tasks of working to provide frames, that is, automatic, effortless, everyday modes of understanding that we desperately need. Chapter 3. Reflexivity, the brain and the world. You might think that the world exists independently of how we understand it. You would be mistaken. Our understanding of the world is part of the world. A physical part of the world. Our conceptual framing exists in physical neural circuitry in our brains, largely below the level of conscious awareness, and they define and limit how we understand the world, and so they affect our actions in the world. The world is thus in many ways a reflection of how we frame it and act on those frames, creating a world in significant part framed by our actions. Accordingly, the frame-inherent world, structured by our framed actions, reinforces those frames and recreates those frames in others as they are born, grow, and mature in such a world. The phenomenon is called reflexivity. The world reflects our understanding through our actions, and our understandings reflect the world shaped by the frame-informed actions of ourselves and others. To function effectively in the world, it helps to be aware of reflexivity. It helps to be aware of what frames have shaped and are still shaping reality if you are going to intervene to make the world a better place. Reflexivity just is. In itself, it is neither a good nor bad thing. It can be either. Framing 102 is about how reflexivity can be used for the good. At least for the good of most people, most living things, and for the beauty and bounty of the physical world that supports all life. In all too many cases, new frames, new forms of understanding, are required to comprehend the world so as to take advantage of reflexivity and make it a better place. This is especially true when the issues confronting us and needing framing are complex and systemic, like global warming, the wealth gap, and many other issues that have risen to great importance over the last decade. Let us proceed. Chapter 4. Systemic Causation. Studying cognitive linguistics has its uses. Every language in the world has in its grammar a way to express direct causation. No language in the world has in its grammar a way to express systemic causation. What's the difference between direct and systemic causation? From infanthood on, we experience simple, direct causation. We see direct causation all around us. If we push a toy, it topples over. If our mother turns a knob on the oven, flames emerge. Picking up a glass of water and taking a drink is direct causation. Slicing bread is direct causation. Punching someone in the nose is direct causation. Throwing a rock through a window is direct causation. Stealing your wallet is direct causation. Any application of force to something or someone that produces an immediate change to that thing or person is direct causation. When causation is direct, the word cause is unproblematic. We learn direct causation automatically as children because that's what we experience on a daily basis. Direct causation and the control over our immediate environment that understanding it allows is crucial in the life of every child. That's why it shows up in the grammar of every language. The same is not true of systemic causation. Systemic causation cannot be experienced directly. It has to be learned, its cases have to be studied, and repeated communication is necessary before it can be widely understood. That's right. No language in the world has a way in its grammar to express systemic causation. You drill a lot more oil, burn a lot more gas, put a lot more CO2 in the air, the Earth's atmosphere heats up, more moisture evaporates from the oceans, yielding bigger storms in certain places and more droughts and fires in other places, and yes, more cold and snow in still other places. Systemic causation. The world ecology is a system, like the world economy and the human brain. As a result, we lack a concept that we desperately need.